Hello and welcome to Talking Tudors, a fortnightly podcast about the ever-fascinating Tudor dynasty. My name is Natalie Gruniger and I'll be your host and guide on this journey through 16th century England. Are you ready to step through the veil of time into the dazzling and dangerous world of the Tudor court? Without further ado, it's time to talk Tudors. Talking Tudors, episode 70. I'm your host, Natalie Gruniger, and it's great to have your company. Before we dive into this week's episode, I'd like to thank the wonderful patrons who continue to support this podcast and thank all of my listeners who've taken the time to rate and review the show. Not only are your kind words a great source of encouragement, but they also help new listeners find the podcast. Another way you can support the work I do is by becoming a Talking Tudors patron. It's super easy to do. Just click on the Be My Patron on Podbean badge on the homepage of my website, www.onthetudortrail.com, or click on the Be a Patron button on the Podbean app. Join the Talking Tudors patron family and you'll be automatically entered into our patron-only monthly giveaways. April's prize is a copy of Cor Rotto, a novel of Catherine Carey by Adrian Dillard. A huge thank you to Adrian for sponsoring this wonderful prize. Now, on to today's episode. I'm thrilled that joining me on the show to talk about chivalry and courtly love is Hilary Jane Locke. Hilary is a PhD student at Macquarie University in Sydney. Her project looks at how historical fiction informs people's perceptions of history. Originally from Adelaide, Hilary completed her undergraduate and Master of Philosophy in History at the University of Adelaide. Her master's thesis examines chivalry and courtly love in the courts of Henry VII and Henry VIII. Our conversation right after this short musical break, courtesy of guitarist John Sayles. Talking Tudors. Hilary, how are you?
Good, thank you. How are you?
I'm well, thank you. And thank you so much for joining me on Talking Tudors. It's lovely to have you here.
Thanks for having me. I'm very excited.
Now, maybe we can just start by you introducing yourself to our listeners and just telling us a little bit about your background.
Oh, so my name's Hilary and I'm almost 30. Originally from Adelaide, where I studied and moved to Sydney, and I'm now doing my PhD here at Macquarie University. And my background with the like Tudors and stuff like that, that's all came from generally just being interested in the Tudor period. And then I studied it at university through my honours and then my Master of Philosophy degree, which I did finished in early 2019.
Fabulous. So was there like a moment that you can remember that really sort of sparked your interest in Tudor history, or was it more just a sort of gradual coming to enjoy that period of time?
Yeah, it's kind of funny now because my PhD is actually on looking at historical fiction, and I actually have my like official confirmation of candidature meeting tomorrow, and I start my presentation talking about this moment when I was about 9 years old when I watched Elizabeth, the movie with Cate Blanchett. It like really stuck with me. I was only like 9 years old, which, you know, in retrospect you're like, why did I watch this as a 9 year old? But I was really fascinated by the costumes, and I remember distinctly like walking around in my bedroom trying to like replicate replicate the costumes with things like, you know, skimmies and like quilts and stuff like that. You know, I was always quite interested in history. So I sort of remember wanting to be an Egyptologist when I was a kid as well, because I watched The Mummy and stuff like that. So it wasn't like history just disappeared. And then I think I must have been about 15 or 16 or something, and I went with my grandma into the city, and on the bookshelf at Dimmicks was Alison Weir's Innocent Trader, the book she wrote about Lady Jane Grey, the novel. It was the costume, like, on there's a image of a girl in a costume in a tuna dress, and I was just like, I need to read that book. And I read it, and then everything from that point onwards was an obsession with tuna history. I was like reading a lot of historical fiction, and then slowly started to bring in, you know, nonfiction texts and stuff, and deliberately went to uni to study history, which, you know, unfortunately I only had like two courses that touched on Tudor history, but made sure that I could study it myself in like honours, and the honours thesis developed into what became my MPhil thesis.
We're going to be chatting about chivalry and courtly love at the Tudor court, but before we sort of dive into that, could you tell us about what these concepts actually mean? That would be, I think, a good place to start.
Good question. So chivalry itself, which is probably a term a lot of your listeners would know as just a general term about how men behave, and like, you know, it's probably associated more so at the moment with like, you know, toxic masculinity and like how, you know, is it chivalrous to open a door for a woman, that kind of thing. And yeah. So these concepts have had a really long trajectory and a long history dating back to very early medieval, and you can see sort of traces of it in the sort of Roman style of living as well. But it's sort of formulated as a concept in the early medieval period around the way that men behave and the way that men perform. It's a very performative concept, so, you know, giving you guidelines on how to behave. But it was very much associated with, so chivalry in particular is very much associated with battlefield mentality of like how you engage in combat, how you behave towards one another, so a chivalrous engagement. But also chivalry was very sort of external to the battlefield as well. So it was something that you did on and off the battlefield. So you behaved as a chivalric man towards people in the very early medieval period, and that sort of concept evolves especially towards the high middle ages and the downfall of the medieval period, where you have a lot of people theorizing about what it actually means. So you have people like Raymond Lull and Geoffroy de Chagny are two very good examples of people who like decided to write handbooks about chivalry to sort of try and frame what it is, and that kind of leads an argument for historians to wonder whether chivalry truly existed in the sort of practical sense, whether it was something that really existed and whether it was more of a theoretical concept. And then courtly love itself is chivalry adjacent, if you could frame it like that, where you've got a lot of people put it down to sort of early 12th and 13th century court relationship behavior. A lot of people say that it was brought to England in particular by Eleanor of Aquitaine, and it was basically guidelines about how you behaved with someone that you could be having a dalliance with. But it was also a lot to do with how it was represented in literature. So, you know, courtly love itself is probably defined more so by how the male suffers rather than the woman engaging in like explicit affairs or whatever. So the woman is suffering, the man is suffering for his love for this woman that he is usually quite unattainable. So a queen or a princess or a highborn lady or something like that. And this man who is also living under these chivalric principles wants to be with this woman. And usually those chivalric principles are what guide him to go and fight and try and impress this lady, which ultimately is unobtainable. And again, courtly love, you see a few people, especially in the sort of early medieval period, writing handbooks about it as well in an attempt to frame it. So I can never say his name properly, but Andreas Capitolinus as well. He was big on, he wrote this fantastic treatise, which is basically a dialogue between two people. And you have like a woman saying, but this and this and this, and the man going, but this, this and this. Like, this is how you frame this conversation about love. And of course, like, you go further along and you get Chaucer writes a lot of courtly love satires as well. So you've got, you know, Troilus and Cressida, which is a fantastic one that satires the whole thing, because Troilus is very, oh, I'm so depressed, I can't fall in love, and this love suffering that he expresses is very much the trope of the courtly love genre. Like, I am suffering for my love of you and you can't reward me and you're so unobtainable, that kind of stuff. Yeah, I hope that answers the question.
Yeah, it's obviously quite a complex
issue. Oh, it's very complicated.
Yeah, yeah, I've read The Art of Courtly Love and I love it. It's so entertaining, all those conversations and, so, you know, everything silly. You're meant to respond and say. It's like, oh, my gosh.
It's really very funny.
It is. But, all right, you know, in lots of popular history books about the Tudors and all that kind of thing, we hear these terms being thrown around, chivalry and courtly love. But let's look specifically at the Tudor reign. What place did they hold at the Tudor court? Was it important? Yeah, maybe if we can delve into that a little bit.
My thesis is basically me sort of sitting back and saying what you rightly said, like these popular biographies, particularly of Henry VIII, and not so much of Henry VII, but they sort of – they name drop a lot. Like, they sort of say, oh, chivalry, he was a chivalrous person and chivalry was important. But I kind of felt that that lacked a lot of context and a lot of misinformation. I think that there is a lot more to this. And the more that I looked at it, the more I realized that there is a lot more to it than those particular biographies or whatever would point out. So chivalry was really big in this particular period, that so much so that, like, everywhere I looked, I could find it. And so with looking at the Tudors in particular, it becomes really important for Henry VII in the way that he starts to build his dynasty, because I'm sure, as most people are aware, like, he had quite a tentative link to the actual throne. And it was important that he not only stabilized his dynasty because of what had been happening with the Wars of the Roses and, like, the fact that they were yo-yoing between kings and everything was a bit chaotic, it also was important for him to sort of continue a legacy as well. So establish that legacy so that even if people didn't genuinely believe that he was the King of England, people could believe that his sons were the Kings of England. So it was about establishing that. And we see that kind of play out in chivalric ways a lot, in how, like, he named his firstborn son Prince Arthur, which is, I always thought it was quite an obvious fact that that was an ode to King Arthur, but not a lot of people talk about it. And I think Stephen Gunn, who's a historian from Oxford, has this fantastic book about how, a lot about Prince Arthur, but he was taken deliberately to Winchester, a place that was historically associated with King Arthur, to be christened. So that was quite an obvious step. So you've also got the idea, like, this thing that I found lacking in the commentary about Prince Arthur as well, is that he would have become King Arthur Tudor. So the first King Arthur after this legend that is King Arthur, who is traditionally associated with Britishness, but also, you know, chivalric principles of being victorious in battle and glorious. And yeah, so you've got that very obvious, like, symbolic gesture from that. So you can see how, like, important that is to him. But also, you know, in day-to-day life, because it's quite a behavioral thing and it's quite a social thing, chivalry kind of informed how Henry VII was able to build up his court after he succeeded to the throne, or took the throne, whatever you want to argue. So, for example, knighting is a big part of chivalric culture. You know, it's not just a symbol of, like, wealth and of title. It's also about, you know, acknowledging this particular person fought well on the battlefield or is loyal to the person who is able to do the knighting and stuff like that. So when Henry VII landed in Wales on his way to the Battle of Bosworth in 1485, he knighted a bunch of people that were with him, and he wasn't king yet, which sort of suggests that he was a bit, you know, ahead of the game and thinking he was going to win this. It's a very symbolic gesture of, like, these people are important to me and they're very loyal to my cause, so I'm going to knight them. And a lot of those families, you find their names pop out time and time again in the Tudor records, so, because they were loyal Lancastrians. But you see this earlier with Edward IV as well, where he was knighting people on battlefields when victories were won as well. Like, he wasn't preempting it, unlike Henry, but I'm pulling all these people that are really loyal to me in close, and that sort of informs how people create political networks, and it's all done through that chivalric discourse of I'm a king and I'm supposed to be the best at being a chivalric, which is something, a be chivalric person, which is something that the people who write the handbooks point out a lot. Like, the king is supposed to be this emblematic symbol of masculine perfection and chivalric perfection in turn. And so then people who are then drawn to this person via knighthoods and stuff, then they start to build those political networks of loyal supporters and stuff. And that has a big effect moving into Henry VIII's reign as well, because you can see the mentality of drawing people close and using people who are loyal and raising them up high and stuff like that. Looking at courtly love, I think courtly love itself has a very interesting way of playing out in how people discuss love, and how they, it sort of creates a bit of a framework for how people discuss love. And going back to Prince Arthur, when he was just about to marry Catherine of Aragon in 1501, there was a manuscript that was made for him, which you can tell through the iconography within the margins, so the marginalia of it, covered with like his little ostrich feather that he had as his symbol. That's full of courtly love poetry. Even if we don't know if he sat down and read this manuscript or not, or whether it was just, you know, a gift or whatever it is. But the presence of it is important to know that, like, he was given this sort of framework and dialogue, especially on the eve of his marriage, to talk to his future bride. You know, I must behave in a certain way to kind of woo her, in a sense, you know, that kind of thing. So that's the way that courtly love kind of plays its way through the Tudor court.
Yeah, that's really interesting, because I was just thinking, is it something, were these frameworks specifically taught to people as young people, or is it something that you just kind of came to absorb, I suppose, as you were growing up?
I'd say that it's absorbing, like, you know, so many cultural things you just absorb. And I think that's the difficult thing about doing cultural history, is that you have to kind of like extract this little thread of something that could either have been quite deliberate, or it could have been something that was sat down and taught to these people. But, you know, education is quite has an interesting role in this, because obviously these royal children had tutors and they were being educated in certain ways. And a bit of my thesis has to toy with this idea that obviously around this time you've also got the emergence of humanist educators, and that is a different framework altogether, because that's about like referring to classic texts to kind of understand and work with what's going on in the present, like in the contemporary time. So it's not relying on sort of the old medieval texts as much, but then you can kind of see it in practical ways. So Arthur and Henry VIII were kind of educated in this humanist framework because of the way that, you know, it's another chivalric ideal, I guess, that your court becomes this sort of hub of bringing people who are creative and can be patronized in, like, in the way that they write. But a lot of the people that came to Henry VII's court, were humanist people from, you know, humanist scholars who were from, like, Italy and France. So it's kind of an interesting clash of ideals there. But Henry VIII, as a young prince, and Arthur were inducted into the Order of the Garter, which again is a huge symbol of chivalric power and pageantry. And I mean, now it's become a little bit more of a sort of farcical representation of like an old institution, but back then it had so much power, relinking back to the idea of those loyal knights being pulled together. This is like the loyalist of the loyal being rewarded. And Henry VII made Arthur was inducted really early. Like, he was something like 7 or 8 years old, and I can't remember off the top of my head. And Henry was inducted at the age of 5, I'm pretty sure. And, you know, historians such as David Starkey have argued that that moment in Henry's timeline sparks this sort of like interest in chivalry. I think he's right in that being included in this sort of like particular gang of people definitely would have influenced his chivalric ideals. It sparks this whole lifelong journey into becoming the chivalric figure that he may or may have not have succeeded at.
Yeah, that's right. And it's interesting. I've been doing looking a little bit into the Knights of the Garter and their, you know, having a look at some of their meetings and things like that. And it is, I suppose, we don't always realize just how exclusive it was, which is more exclusive than the nobility, for example, because it was restricted, obviously, in numbers. So that's really important. And I suppose from what you're saying, the sort of sense I'm getting is that, you know, chivalry and courtly love, as complex as these your notions are, were really critical to the performance of kingship during this time. Am I getting the right sense there?
Oh, totally. And like, yeah. I think a lot of people definitely forget that the Tudor, especially the early Tudor period, is still quite medieval in the way that it functioned And so chivalry would be had been such an important principle in the way that kingship had been formulated for such a long time that they're not just going to like flip a switch and go, oh, suddenly we're early modern and we're all like, you know, parliament runs us and we, you know, all that sort of stuff. It's still such an important principle to how things function. And I think I'll probably touch on this a little bit later, but a lot of the like way that people were trying to bring some sense into the world after the Wars of the Roses had caused such dramatic upheaval was by looking at what had worked previously. And chivalry was an idea that had worked previously to bring people to some sort of socialized manner, whether or not that is actually true, because we can't tell, because these people were just referring to like literary work. Whether or not it was actually true is a different story. But the idea is that chivalry just, you know, it penetrates so much of cultural understanding of how, like, what a man should do. And I mean, you can kind of still see it today if you were to have a think about like how we look at from an early age, we're kind of given these Disney princes who are all very much this chivalric ideal of like, you know, running and saving the woman and being honorable and being respectful and all that sort of stuff. And that's sort of an indication of like that chivalric principle continuing on in how it informs masculine performance as well. But yes, it definitely was a huge part of how a king is meant to be a king, how that informs how courtiers then related to him as a king.
Yeah, so let's look at it on a sort of practical level. How did chivalry affect the sort of everyday relationships that are going on between men and women at court?
Between men, it was very important. On an everyday level, it's quite hard to measure. I think that's something that I should make clear. Like, it's very hard to sort of sit down and go, oh, I see, you can see on an everyday level, this person's talking to this person in a way. Like, there's just no source material for that kind of interaction. But you can sort of paint a general picture. So if you're a man at court from, say, Henry the VII's reign all the way through to sort of the early part of Henry the VIII's reign, you were expected to behave in a certain way in the court environment. So you were expected to present yourself in a chivalrous manner. And that comes through in sort of some sources that were published at the time. So, for example, Henry the VII patronized Christina de Pizan's Book of Chivalry, which I think to me suggests that he kind of has some knowledge of that text. But that text is it's sort of basically a rundown manual of how we're supposed to be chivalrous and how you're supposed to interact with people and you're supposed to be this respectful way. And if you upheld those chivalric values, Henry the VII would promote you. So people like I mentioned, the knights who got knighted on the beach in Wales, people still continue to find their way into courtly hierarchy through those chivalric methods. So Gilbert Talbot was inducted into the Order of the Garter after someone had died, so there was a place left. He got there simply because he fought in some of the uprisings and helped protect Henry the VII's reign. He also fought at the Battle of Bosworth, so he was also part of that little crew, but he wasn't knighted at that particular stage. So you can see that kind of playing its part. Like, he wasn't a particularly high-ranking noble, but because he was going out of his way to continue these chivalric practices and being chivalric in the court, he was able to get to that high rank of the Order of the Garter, and that sort of left him with a position later on that kind of secured him income for life. But also the other part of it is just that performative element. So if you're part of the court, you'd go out and, you know, you'd do general activities like a hunting practice, which was a very chivalric pastime for a lot of people. Bow and arrow practices, that was a big thing. Jousting was a huge thing. So a lot of the practical physical activities that were done at courts, in court settings, and a lot of those particular activities were attached to celebrations as well. So you have combat with people in armor, or the jousting matches, that was all attached to celebrations. A lot of those practical activities are all linked to that chivalric tradition of like showing prowess in the battlefield and stuff, but it's scaled down, so it's only, you know, hand-to-hand combat and that kind of stuff. And then generally speaking, when we move into Henry the VIII's court, it becomes a very interesting thing, because it seems to be that Henry himself was a very chivalric figure. And I guess the little cluster of men like the Privy Council and all his other friends were quite chivalric in the way that they went about their activities. Henry wrote a lot of performs a lot. He wrote a lot of lyrics. He was very much into his sports. So that was all tied into that chivalric persona. That then sort of played out, that kind of contrasted a little bit with the way that his like court was being run, particularly by these people like Cardinal Wolsey and Cromwell and these humanist thinkers, and Thomas More as well, these humanist thinkers who were kind of thinking a little bit more theoretically about processes and government and, yeah, money saving and all this sort of stuff. Whereas Henry's sort of like, yeah, I'm going to be the chivalric here. And I think that kind of represents the kind of environment that he grew up in compared to the environment that the thinking and the processes that these particular political players goals in mind of like trying to preserve the realm as much as, you know, Henry's desire to spend money and put on these magnificent particular events and stuff like that.
Henry VIII, you know, that's a controversial topic where we talk about chivalry and Henry VIII, but it's quite clear that he obviously saw himself, or he wanted to be, this kind of chivalric, you know, ideal or model for the people around him. Would you agree with that? Even though I don't, you know, we could argue whether he succeeded in that or whether there was some change.
Of course, I'm always happy to talk about Henry VIII. So he, I think he's one of those profoundly misunderstood historical characters. Not that I think that I could change him or anything, but I think he is very fascinating as a person who is completely contradictory, and I think he just didn't know what he wanted. But I think a big part of that is like how chivalry played a role in his mentality, and very early on from day dot we have people who are writing poems about how chivalric he is and how magnificent he's going to be compared to, I mean, even in the commentary you've got, you know, Thomas More wrote a coronation ode when he was first crowned, and it was very, very like humanistic and very like representative of the rising of humanist thought, because we've educated him this way and, you know, this is brilliant. But even other poets who are writing at the time uplifted him as this chivalric hero. He's just the opportunity of a golden age, basically, is what they're trying to say, because Henry VII obviously was quite insulated and very frugal by the time he'd finished, by the time he died. So I think the country kind of just needed a little bit of a boost, and this is what these poets are writing about. And Henry VIII took that to heart. Like he really did. You know, we see him in 1511 parading himself as Sir Loyalheart at the joust, which is a huge part of chivalry, is this like role playing of the chivalric character, the epitome of being a knight. And that's kind of one of a few instances we see him kind of interacting with Catherine of Aragon like that as well. Like, I'm sure people have probably seen it depicted in popular culture, but, you know, the idea of giving favors as well, that was part of that courtly love role play of, here, wear my favor, it'll grant you luck. So, you know, a hanky, a piece of fabric, kind of anything that grant the particular person luck. And that whole Sir Loyalheart thing that happened in 1511, which was also a joust to celebrate the birth of his first son, Prince Henry, brought Catherine into playing that. And it wasn't just him as well. It was his other like courtiers as well were playing these roles. They also had names that rarely get remembered and stuff. So he also did things with Robin Hood, the Robin Hood myth as well. Like he dressed up as Robin Hood. There's quite a famous encounter where he like sort of turned up while Catherine was a few months pregnant and having a bit of a rest, dressed as Robin Hood and pretended not to know who she was and all this sort of stuff, like to kind of just play into this role. And also like he spent, there's records of how much money he spent on masks and performances. And he just liked playing into that chivalric character a lot. And I think that that is really interesting psychologically, because I think it just influences how he sees himself. He's so driven to go off and fight a war as well. And I think that's something that a lot of the, especially the popular culture depictions have, they've taken to heart as well. If you think of Jonathan Rhys-Meyers' particular performance in The Tudors, he's very much, I want to be the next Henry V. I'm going to win the Agincourt of our era and all this sort of stuff. And like, there's no actual evidence to suggest that that's what he wanted to do, but he was very determined to enter into battles to get that particular notoriety associated with chivalry. and Shivarik a performance. He's just really fascinating in how he like holds all that stuff really close to heart, and you can see it in how he shows off his court to foreign dignitaries as well. And part of that role play obviously is also that reveal at the end that like I was the king all along.
Yeah.
And everyone's supposed to go, oh, Henry is so great, you know. But it's like yeah, part of that, like that it's kind of cheeky in a way, I think. And it works quite well in those early parts of his reign.
All right. Yeah, I think it was Starkey. I agree with you. He's quite fascinating, Henry. And I think it was Starkey or Professor Ives. Starkey, I think, that said that Henry is the greatest psychological enigma. And I have to say, just you know, having studied him for a long time, I completely agree. One moment you think you've got him all understood, and the next moment you're like, what has happened here? So that's so true. Now, you talked about role playing, and I find that really interesting because obviously there are a few situations that occur, and we're hopefully going to talk about a couple of those now, where other people don't play their role as they're expected to, or they cross some sort of imaginary lines in this business with courtly love and chivalry. So let's think about Anne Boleyn's downfall, for example. And the other one that pops to mind is, of course, Anne of Cleves, where she doesn't recognize that Henry's come in, you know, disguise. So can we talk about that a little bit and how those ideals and those roles affected his relationship specifically with his wives? That would be really great.
His relationship with his wives are really fascinating. So I sort of did a thing for my thesis saying like a courtly love reading of particular events. And that kind of brings this light into the dynamics between his relationships with his wives. And it was really important for me to do that with his relationship with Anne Boleyn as well, because, you know, for a long time I was the, you know, diehard Anne Boleyn fan and everything. I just found that all the sort of biographies and stuff that were around were kind of telling the same story. And once I sort of stepped back and looked at some of the source material that we do have, you kind of notice this courtly love discourse and this courtly love framework that just really emphasizes how much courtly love played a role in how Henry VIII courted her, but then also the opposite of how it kind of led to her downfall. And I'd really recommend reading, there's a book chapter by the historian Susanna Liscombe about it, which is basically talks about how the downfall in particular can be looked at through this courtly love lens. And you start to notice that it's Henry VIII reading the situation completely literally, if that makes sense. So what happens with Anne and the other courtiers that causes her to be arrested? And that sort of, you know, play on words and that kind of like cheeky kind of courtly love thing of saying to, it was Henry Norris, wasn't it? Saying that, you know, you look for dead man's shoes, that kind of thing. That's quite a courtly love, just being a bit flirty and a bit cheeky, from most accounts, you know, Anne was quite that kind of person. And it makes sense because she was like growing up in those courtly environments where courtly love was a form of communication between genders. So yeah, then that sort of translates into how we see the downfall happen with Henry. Instead of going, oh, this is courtly love and that's fine, it becomes a thing where Henry VIII kind of sees his honor as being completely betrayed. You know, it's this chivalric character that's been completely squashed by all these men. And so you can kind of understand that maybe that's why he went to such extremes to get rid of all of them, instead of just going, okay, you're all arrested and off you go, or I forgive you, or whatever he had done with other people in that particular situation, like Thomas Wyatt. He got rid of them all because he just kind of perceived what they had done or had been perceived to have done as such a besmirchment on his honor that he just couldn't stand them to be around anymore. And that's a particular thing that comes really clearly through the way that the trial record, which may or may not be a contemporary record, we'll just put that out there, but that particular trial record does have the instances of that illicit, like the boundary crossing illicitness of, you know, the way that it describes how George and Anne interacted, but also with the other people as well. Like she's just this one long line of people that are just like coming in and out of her bedchamber. It's just that crossing that line of the illicit, which becomes obviously not the role play anymore.
Yeah. What about with Anne of Cleves? What happened there?
She's a very fascinating one because obviously she's that wife that gets left out a lot, and her arriving in England in 1540, she basically turned up and Henry decided that he was going to go meet her, which is completely against all royal protocol. You know, you guys meet at a specific time and, you know, you meet each other formally and all this sort of stuff. He decides to rock up dressed as someone else. So dressed not as the king. So he's just like, you know what, this is a really good idea. Keep in mind, this is now, 1540. He's not great mentally. He's got that horrible ulcer in his leg. He's probably weighing like twice his like original body weight. He's not a very attractive man. Yeah, he just decides. There's no record in the sources why he just decided to do this. He just did. And I don't know whether it was part of that, you know, he was besotted with her portrait and he thought he might play this game to just kind of hark back to that, reference back to that sort of youth of chivalric role play that we saw in like the early 1510s. Yeah, he just rocks up dressed as someone else and I think is told that there's someone here to meet you. She goes out and Henry's like, hi, I'm not the king. How's it going? Welcome to the country. And then he just kisses her on the mouth, which she's just horrified. She, like, and you know, rightly so. She's quite young. She's very, as we know, quite innocent. She has quite strong Protestant ethics, Lutheran ethics. So she's just taken aback and she just freaks out. And I think she scolds him a little bit. She's just like, I don't know what you did. Like, why'd you do that? And then he just immediately is like, what is this woman doing? She doesn't know what she's doing. And gets really sour about it. And so, yeah, and then he reveals that he's the king and she just like, she immediately like curtsies and shows him the like respect and stuff. And she just obviously can't take that interaction back. And I think it has a huge part on the psychology of Henry's relationship with her because he's unable to see past this initial reaction of disgust that she had for him, which I don't think he was very familiar with. And also she didn't play into that, you know, which he was so used to, didn't play into this idea that, you know, he was eventually going to be like, I'm the king. And she'd go, ah, ha, ha, ha. That's so funny. But I mean, at the same time, it kind of, you think about it, if she had gone along with it and just like kissed this random person and enjoyed it, I'm sure he would have had the same kind of reaction. Obviously that marriage lasts 6 months and they didn't consummate it. And I think that had a huge part in it because she was just so outside of that courtly environment. So she didn't know those principles of how to like engage with him in those ways. And like, as we see from the letters that he wrote with Anne Boleyn, wrote to Anne Boleyn, those letters are just full of courtly love discourse. I am suffering and you're unobtainable and you're, you know, even referencing his own like chivalric persona. He calls himself Loyalheart at one point, which I think is fascinating. Like, he's referencing his own jousting persona. Courtly love is so entrenched in how he approaches his particular whoever he's courting. So the fact that Anne of Cleves reacted that way just threw him completely under the bus.
Yeah, I always feel for Anne of Cleves. I think, why did someone prepare her? This was a guy that loved dressing up, doing it all the time, and she was so unprepared, the poor girl. Like, that's just
completely unprepared, just everything.
Heartbreaking.
Just not even that. Like, she just was unprepared for it. And I think she kind of did well out of the whole situation.
Yes, but I'm sure
she was very traumatized.
And you mentioned earlier about how these kind of chivalric ideals and the practice played out on the battlefield and off the battlefield. So what about when we're talking in terms of warfare? How did chivalric practice inform warfare? You've touched on it a little bit, but maybe let's just go into that a little bit.
Yeah, so something that I came across during my research and something that not a lot of historians I've noticed of this particular period talk about is there's a particular terminology in the documents calling warfare a war of necessity or of glory, which I found really fascinating because obviously warfare, as we go through into, it's a bit hard to measure it for Henry VII's reign because doesn't engage in too much after the Wars of the Roses. There's a particular document of a Venetian ambassador who comes over and sort of talks about how he's like set up his finances and things like that, like Henry's set up his finances. And he mentions that there is a certain percentage of taxation that will be allocated to war if it's for necessity, and a certain more percentage of taxation allocated to a war if it's for glory, which I found really interesting, that there's more more money that is allocated for a warfare that is perceived to be for the glory of the nation rather than for the protection or the necessity of the nation. And this is a particular concept that Henry VIII really struggles with, particularly as we move into the 1520s and you've got the people who are basically these humanist thinkers controlling the finances of the country and just kind of letting Henry do his own thing. But he really wanted to enter into a warfare with France. Like we had an initial one in 1513, which he had some minor victories with. He had war with Scotland in 1513 as well at the same time, which he was victorious with, which I still find weird because that was his brother-in-law. So I don't know what his thought was there. But yeah, that determination to go and win a war against France was something that he couldn't let go. You see this conversation happening in about 1523-24 when there is this conflict between France and the emperor, the Holy Roman Emperor, who is also Catherine of Aragon's nephew, just tossing and turning about what we should do. And eventually they come to the decision to side with the emperor, and they describe it as being a warfare of necessity. However, this doesn't reduce any sort of glory or victory that would come to Henry if he was to be successful during this war, which I find very interesting because it's kind of like a sort of very, it's a basically Wolsey is this one who's like talking about this in the parliament, and Wolsey's being this huge spin doctor essentially saying like it's important that we do this for the necessity of the perceived threat of French invasion, but also because it will bring glory. And this is a very interesting psychological trick that I think Wolsey plays on Henry quite a lot, and I think Thomas Cromwell also plays on Henry a lot, that, you know, if we are to do this, it has to be because it's really necessary, but it can still bring you glory nevertheless. So it's kind of like tying those two concepts together. I think what's a bigger indication of this particular idea that he was so determined is that by the time all of these people had gone, because he'd got rid of them in about 1544, he enters into an invasion of France at Bologna. That is like the height of this chivalric dream. And he's overweight. He can't fight in the battle, but he still is determined to go overseas, over the channel, and fight in this particular war. It's because there's no one there to stop him. If you think about it, there's not a huge amount of conflict between sort of the 1520s all the way up to the 1540s. There's a lot of internal conflict, but there's not a huge amount of going out and finding a war to fight. And I think there's a little bit happening in Scotland and Ireland, just kind of non-wars that are worth mentioning, that kind of thing. But he deliberately goes and he fights this war because there is no one there to stop him. There's no one there to say, sorry, this isn't a good idea. All the people that are around him are like yes men, essentially. And so he goes and does that, and he has a minor success, but it's just an awful situation. Like, people are dying of, can't remember exactly what the disease was, but they were just dying of malnourishment, essentially. It was a horrible situation. They eventually claimed the victory and then came back, and everyone's like, yay, Henry, like, you've done a job. But yeah, it's an interesting situation where he's obviously so determined, even though he's physically unable to do it, to go over there and win this victory. And there's a particularly fantastic quote which I found when I found it during my research. I was like almost jumping around in my office because it's so good, where he says, I'll have to paraphrase it because it's written in Middle English and I can't speak Middle English, but basically he says, as a Christian prince, I know that I shouldn't be going to war, but as a man, I want to go to war. And it kind of that and I think that kind of symbolizes this like drive in him that he is, apart from the fact that he has the responsibility of ruling the country, he really wants to go and have that, you know, boy's own adventure kind of experience in a war. I think that sort of encompasses that mentality that he has throughout his whole reign, even though quite a lot of the time he's preoccupied with his own personal affairs and business and internal conflicts.
Yeah, I love that quote. I don't think I've ever heard that before. So I can understand why you would jump up and down.
So good.
so good. All right. So you talked a little bit about how the chivalry and courtly love is, of course, represented in the literature and publications of the day. Can you tell us a little bit more about that?
Yeah, sure. So I'll start with William Caxton, who is basically the first person to bring the printing press to London. He worked under the patronage of Edward IV for a while there. He was working in Burgundy, and I think he was working a little bit in the Netherlands as well beforehand. Got to know Edward's family when he was in exile during the sort of second reign of Henry VI. It's very confusing. The second reign of Henry VI, during like the Wars of the Roses. And then when Edward got reinstated as the king, William Caxton came over and he got patronized by Edward. His catalogue and his printing catalogue is just a plethora of chivalric texts. He's one of the first people who prints St. Thomas Malory's Maud's Arthur, which is called just King Arthur in his catalogue. I mentioned before there's a text by Romain Lull. Can never say his name properly. I think he's French. So his text is basically a book of chivalry. He prints that. I also mentioned he prints a couple of things patronised by Henry VII, which was a book about chivalry. And also we have Margaret Beaufort, who's Henry VII's mum, patronizing a text about, it's called Blanchard and Eglantine, which is a courtly love story, which is all about the suffering induced by this courtly love tale on the man. The woman's fine. His texts are just this like plethora of it. And he's translating a lot of these from Latin or from French into English so that people who read English can access them. And what I found so fascinating about his work is that he wrote prologues and epilogues to these texts as well. So these prologues and epilogues are an absolute goldmine in indicating how much of an important cultural thing chivalry was. My thesis is just littered with his quotes because they're just beautiful. My favorite one is that he basically says in the prologue to King Arthur that we should read these books because there shall you see manhood. And I think that is beautiful, that just like we need to be reading these because you need to know how to act like a man. And that sort of legacy carries on a little bit into Henry VIII's period. We have Wynkyn de Worde, who carries on that printing press after Caxton dies. He reissues King Arthur or Maud to Arthur in the 1520s. We also have some interesting manuscripts that are being made around that time as well. And they're like an absolute goldmine as well, because you've got this compilation of texts that are being put together all the way from, you know, Edward IV's reign all the way through, of these chivalric texts that were in the royal libraries of these particular monarchs as well. So there was a sort of amount of cultural capital that was attached to these things, because manuscripts are obviously not very cheap to make. They were definitely there for show. All these illuminations that were attached to them as well. In the 1520s in particular, you've got these particular wealthy people who are patronizing publications. So the Duke of Norfolk patronizes particular Roman texts, which kind of harks back to that humanist idea that, you know, you're reviving the old classics and things like that. But it was a very heavy-handed text that pointed at criticism of the new men. And I think everyone knows that Thomas Howard was very anti-Thomas Cromwell and anti-Wolsey in particular for a while. So this sort of idea that he's able to criticize the new men through this like particular text. But what's interesting about it is that there's a prologue attached to it by the person who translated it and published it, Alexander Barclay. And he just goes on these pages and pages and pages of praising the Duke of Norfolk for how amazingly chivalrous he is, because of course he was quite a prolific military campaigner as well. Like he was involved in the Scottish campaign, and he was involved in like short little campaigns in Ireland and stuff like that. So it's just crazy amount of like, oh, we've got to praise him and he's amazing. And then of course Henry VIII also patronized particular volumes of chronicles that were associated with the Hundred Years' War. I can also never say his name because I'm really bad at French, but it's Froissart, the Chronicles of the Hundred Years' War. And also John de Rohan's Chronics Angleterre, I think that's what it's called.
Oh yes, yeah.
Yeah. So he's got these particular works that he's interested in having, these like, you know, these chivalric works that are within his library that he either has read or they just sit there. But the fact that he patronizes them is quite an interesting factor. And then if you look at sort of the courtly love stuff, this is all coming out in lyrical form. So it's all coming out in the lyrics poetry essentially that courtiers are writing. So people are probably quite familiar with Thomas Wyatt's work. That's all very, it's like humanistic but also courtly love in its like way that he's obviously that quite suffering person, but it's also quite political. But then you've got the Devonshire manuscript, which is also quite a fascinating document all on its own, and scholars spend their whole entire lives just using this particular manuscript for their work. It's got contributions from whole bunch of different courtiers, including Margaret Douglas, who was Henry VIII's niece, and her was fiancé, but turned out not to be courtly love dalliance situation. Thomas Howard. Thomas Wyatt's work is in here. It's a lot of replications from Chaucer, Mary Shelton, who was also a courtier with Anne Boleyn, and Mary Howard as well, who was married to Henry Fitzroy. So there's all these women, which is one of the reasons why this document's so fantastic, is that it's all these women from the court who are like putting text and stuff in here. But it's also showing this sort of interesting dynamic playing out in terms of the gender roles that courtly love shows. So we have Thomas Howard, all of his entries are basically the woe is me suffering. So even if there's stuff that he hasn't written there, like mostly his stuff is Chaucer, he's taking these Chaucer little tidbits of Chaucer and like putting them in the manuscript to kind of show how much he loves Margaret Douglas and how much he's suffering for this love. And a lot of her entries, some of them are her own original compositions, a lot of them show this sort of like, I love him, but I'm also a member of the royal family, so I'm feeling that tension and I don't quite know how to deal with it. So you can kind of see those traditional gender roles of courtly love playing out there, with, you know, Thomas being quite dramatic, whereas Margaret Douglas is sort of being quite, trying to rationalize it as much as possible and sort of trying to pull herself away to be that unobtainable figure. So yeah, that's quite like a rush summary basically of how the literature portrays these things. But it was just, it's so present within those, like all the way from William Caxton through to the Devonshire manuscript, all that stuff that is being put out there by these people who are patronizing, but also people who are like writing as well. And of course, Henry VIII was writing this stuff as well in his love lyrics and his letters and his, all his songs that he composed. Yeah, it's just quite a prolific amount of literature that's being produced that is reflecting on these themes.
Yeah, it's so fascinating. So you obviously, you know, looked at a lot of that material when you were trying to ascertain the presence of chivalry and courtly love at the Tudor court. Are there any other sort of sources that stand out for you that, I don't know, maybe surprised you or contained stuff you weren't expecting, or any other interesting sources that you want to comment on?
I was just astounded by how much it was everywhere. Like, yeah. I think that, and like, that's something that, you know, you sit down to, you come up with a topic when you're doing an MPhil and you're kind of like, oh, because, you know, an MPhil doesn't have to be, it doesn't have to be original in the way they approach a topic. Like, it doesn't have to be something that no one's ever done before. It needs to obviously provide a contribution. So I stepped back and kind of went, okay, I could have a look at this, and then realize just how much source material I'd have to work with. And I spent so much time realizing that I'd have to like teach myself how to read Middle English. Like, that was fun. And I think that that's something that I find amazingly undervalued, I think, is the amount of source material that is available to Tudor researchers online. So I never did a research trip, and that's something that I'm quite proud of. I was able to do a lot of it online, and it all came in the form of digitized sources, but also of, you know, the databases that are available. And a lot of those databases provided original source material, pictures and copies and stuff like that. And I think that's what I found. There's particular like little tiny sources that weren't even a big part of my thesis that just stood out to me. Like, there's a letter that I had to try and read through and decipher, because it's a horrible like scan of it, and it was all written in like squiggly Tudor writing, and I couldn't get through it. But it was basically a letter from Margaret Tudor, Henry VIII's sister, to Henry VIII, basically imploring him to release Margaret Douglas from imprisonment because of her relationship with Thomas Howard. So basically, they had a dalliance. They said that they were engaged, and Henry VIII found out. Meanwhile, this happened just after Anne Boleyn was executed as well, so I don't think he was particularly in a great frame of mind. But he found out and just was, that's it, you're out of here. And Margaret had obviously been sent to the court to like find a husband, as they want to do in the Tudor period. And she ended up with this guy who, he was just one of the Howards, if that makes sense. Just one of the many Howards that were, they both got sent to prison. So in this time, Margaret Tudor obviously found out about this and sent a letter to Henry. And it's just this wonderfully written letter of skirting around the issue that Henry had done something really stupid and basically being like, you're an idiot, brother, like, let my daughter go. But she uses all this like plethora of chivalric language and like honoring his chivalric majesty and all this sort of stuff to kind of skirt around this issue that, I mean, he ended up releasing Margaret to imprisonment at Sion Abbey, but Thomas Howard died in prison. So it wasn't exactly a joyful ending for them. But I mean, Margaret also then went on and did it again. And that is another one of those little sources that I found where she, I can't remember exactly who the guy was. I think it might have been another Howard. I'm not 100% sure. But she ended up having the same sort of relationship with another person during Catherine Howard's reign as queen. So, yeah, it probably was a Howard. So I just sort of went through the particular database I was looking at, just looking for, like, any references to Margaret Douglas and stuff. And this particular letter had this fantastic quote saying something along the lines of, beware the third time, essentially saying to Margaret Douglas, if she's caught doing this again, she will be exiled from court, which is it's a like amazing little thing. So I think of all the source material that I like observed and read and combed through and tried to find these things, those two examples just show like the absolute delight of finding something where you're like how is this not been found before, or how is this sort of scraped under the radar, or fascinating little tidbits essentially of how those relationships play out on a big, like on the bigger stage, you know?
Yeah, it's so true. The letters, I'm absolutely obsessed with original letters, and a few of my lovely friends have nicknamed my house Q Down Under because I order so many things from the National Archives.
Oh, well, so fair.
Yeah, well, as you say, look, we're here. We're both in Sydney, and now, especially now, you know, I had a research trip booked for June. Unfortunately, that's not going to be able to take place, but, you know, that's okay. It'll happen one day when this is all behind us. But yes, online, so many fantastic things and resources and ordering stuff from the archives. It's great. Now, Hillary, it's been such a fantastic conversation. I don't want to let you go, but I'm going to have to at some point. So we're up to the point where we play our little game of 10 to go. So just 10 quick questions to get to know you a little bit better. Are you ready for that?
Oh, I am ready.
Excellent. What is a sort of favorite possession of yours? Maybe like a treasured, you know, gift from someone.
It's actually quite hard because a lot of my stuff's still back in Adelaide, and I have a little collection of my own possessions here. It's probably, at the moment, it's probably a little wood carving thing that my dad did. He passed away in 2015, and that's bad, I can't even remember. No, 2015. And he did these things where he like found really hacked up pieces of wood, and he kind of like smoothed them down and sanded them down and varnished them and stuff, and so they look really beautiful. And I managed to bring that back up with me from my last trip to Adelaide, so now it sits on my little bookshelf, and it's really beautiful, and I can like, it's got a little like nook in it so I can stick a candle in there as well, so that kind of, yeah, so that's probably it at the moment. Yeah. Other than that, probably my master's degree. I mean, it's pretty cool.
Yes, well, yeah, totally. What about music? What music do you enjoy listening to?
Oh, a lot of different kinds of stuff. So if I'm working, I'll listen to a lot of soundtrack. I'll listen to gaming soundtracks are quite good, actually.
Oh, okay.
Recommend that. There's a video game soundtrack playlist on Spotify. That's really good. But also I used to, a lot when I was writing my thesis, I used to listen to a lot of Tudor-based music. But I just went to WOM Adelaide over the long weekend in Adelaide. And there was a band called, I'll give them a shout out, Rura, so it's spelled Rura, and they're a Scottish contemporary folk band, and they're amazing. I've not stopped listening to them at all since that weekend. They're so good. Like, they're mostly instrumentals, and yeah, they're really good because I grew up in like going to folk festivals, and I did Irish dancing as a kid, so that folk music is quite ingrained in my like sense of self and stuff. But yeah, it's just kind of a better contemporary edge to it. There's a bagpipes in it, but they play with the violin, so they kind of temper each other out. Oh, it's really nice. Good.
Yeah, I'm going to listen to that. That sounds good.
Yeah, good. They're on Spotify.
Excellent. And what's a book that you sort of wish everyone would read?
Oh, actually, you know, Eggshell Skull by Bree Lee. It's not Tudor related at all. Yeah, definitely should read that one. It's a memoir written by Bree Lee, who she was working as a lawyer apprentice in Queensland Court, and she also then pursued her own historic sexual abuse case. It's a memoir about that whole process, and she's just a fantastic fantastic person. And she also has really good Instagram. So follow her on Instagram. Okay.
Did you say eggshell skull? Is it called
eggshell skull? Yeah.
All right. And what about a favorite form of exercise for you?
I have just gotten into Pilates and it's amazing. Yeah. I put it off for such a long time and then started and I was like, this is the best. But now I can't do it at the moment because.
Yeah. Well, you could do like there are some online.
Yeah.
You could do the online lessons type thing that we're all going to have to be doing soon. Do you have any, you've told us about the gaming music. Do you have any other kind of writing rituals?
I started writing a thesis journal actually late last year. And I really found that quite cathartic. I was very much I don't do journals and I'm really bad at keeping them. And to be honest, I have gone quite lax on them. But yeah, I find there's something actually quite therapeutic in the sitting down and writing something. So I think apart from trying to actually get up early and make an effort to go into uni and things like that, writing the journal is actually really good. I really like that.
Do you have any pets? I feel like maybe I heard one before.
Oh, no, I don't have any.
That's so strange. No. I really feel like I heard one and it's a ghost pet on the
I wish it was a ghost pet. No, well, when we moved up here, my housemate actually had huskies. And so I've sort of become the surrogate dog auntie for them. So I'll count them. Absolutely beautiful dogs.
All right. And what about a song? I think we all need a bit of mood lifting at the moment. Do you have a song that kind of instantly lifts your mood when you play it?
It's Cornflake Girl by Tori Amos, which I never thought would be a thing that I listened to. But yeah, that's kind of – oh, the other thing I also listen to cheer me up is the Six musical.
Oh, that is fantastic. That's
yeah, really I've got it pretty much on repeat at that, like after I saw it. I was just on repeat the whole time.
Funny, I think House of Holbeinus was my favorite.
I really love Get Down. Get Down is my favorite.
Yeah, that's fun. So if anyone hasn't listened to that, we recommend you do that.
Definitely do.
Now, not to make light of obviously the seriousness of what's going on around the world at the moment, if you could be in lockdown with a person from the past, a historical character, who would you choose?
I would not choose Henry VIII.
That'd be a bit scary, I think.
He just loses his mind. I feel like maybe like a suffragette or something from the turn of the century. Yeah. Someone who has something to talk about. I don't think it would be one of the Pankhursts. I just feel like somebody from that era would be an interesting chat because they're not too far away, but they're also far away enough that it'd be an interesting, revealing conversation. But I don't really have any, like, you know, someone would probably say Oscar Wilde or Jane Austen or something like that. I don't really have any of that kind of answer.
All good. And lucky last, obviously we're all kind of looking for ways to, you know, relax a little bit and in these challenging times, what's something that you do to, I don't know, recharge the batteries and relax?
Well, at the moment, I have been mostly taking myself away from the living room area and just watching something on my laptop. I've been getting to on SBS On Demand in Australia, there's a lot of international dramas. So I've been watching a lot of cooking shows and Norwegian dramas for some reason. I don't know why that's stuck out to me. But under normal circumstances, a lot of the time my boyfriend's a huge gamer, so he'll just be gaming and playing stuff and I'll just read and I'll get through so many books just sitting next to him just reading while he's playing games that do not interest me or vaguely interest me that I'll look up and then go back to reading. So yeah, that's
definitely
really, really good for my mental health, just reading.
Fantastic. And the very, very last thing we do on Talking Tutors is I ask my guests for a tutor takeaway. So something that our listeners can go and have a look at or read or listen to after the episode. So do you have a tutor takeaway for us?
I definitely do. The British Library Digitized Manuscript Collection, which will probably be fantastic for any history buffs at the moment who are just kind of wanting something to do. You can narrow it down by dates. And I think also they have a specific Henry VIII collection on their digitized manuscripts page, all areas of history as well. You can look from stuff that all the way from the early 11th century, I think, all the way through. Just amazing. Just looking at the illuminations, even if you can't read the texts and stuff that are on the page, you can click on them and zoom in and look at them really in depth. And it was a huge help during my thesis, but also it's just a beautiful resource. And I'm very grateful to the British Library for putting that online. But yeah, that would be my main takeaway for that, for people to go and look at.
Yeah, Yeah, thank you for that. That's a great one. And I'll add the link to that in the show notes so that everyone can check it out. And that is hours of fun there waiting for you. Yeah. More than hours, probably going to days actually. And some really interesting illustrations you find if you look.
There's some very interesting monkeys doing some fun things.
Yeah, there's lots of interesting things. I love that. Well, Hilary, it's been so wonderful talking to you. And, you know, I know you've got a bit of a cold, so thank you so much for making the time and the effort. Just a little cold. That's all good. So I'm really grateful for you taking the time to talk to you just with us.
Oh, thank you. Is it okay if I add something as well?
Yeah, of course. Go for it.
As part of my PhD project, I'm also doing a survey as part of the research, because I'm interested in how people read historical fiction and how they then use that to perceive history and how that informs their knowledge about history. So would it be okay if I added the link, gave you the link for the show notes?
Yes.
Excellent.
Absolutely. So it's a survey for listeners that they can take?
Absolutely. Yeah. It only takes between 15 and 20 minutes. And basically all I'd ask is how you read your historical fiction, your experiences with it, and it will go towards my PhD research. I'd love to hear if there are any some cool, quirky Tudor historical fiction that your listeners have found and I've really enjoyed as well.
Fantastic. Yeah, definitely. Send me the link. I'll add it in the show notes and more than happy to add it in our wonderful Talking Tudors Facebook group as well, which is very active.
Oh, yeah, that's so good.
Yeah, so if that helps, that's not a problem. All right, well, lovely speaking with you.
Thank you so much.
Well, that brings us to the end of this episode of Talking Tudors. Thank you so much for joining us. I absolutely love to hear from listeners, so if you have any comments or suggestions, or just want to say hi, please get in touch with me via my website, www.onthetudortrail.com, where you'll also find show notes for today's episode. If you've enjoyed the show, please share the podcast with friends and family, and don't forget to subscribe, rate, and review. I also invite you to join our Talking Tudors podcast group on Facebook, where you can interact with other Tudor history lovers and hear all the behind-the-scenes news. You'll also find me on Twitter. My handle is On The Tudor Trail, and on Instagram as The Most Happy 78. It's time now for us to re-enter the modern world. As always, I look forward to talking Tudors with you again very soon.